Welcome to the River of Calm's Beyond the Music podcast. I'm your host, Ed Basil, and the River of Calm is music to soothe your soul. And our Beyond the Music podcast gives you a closer look at the artists who are on the River of Calm. And today in the studio, we have hammered dulcimer artist extraordinaire, Ted Yoder. Ted, welcome.
Thank you, Ed. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. And this is a rare day off for you, so we're very lucky to catch you here. The hardest working man in dulcimer business is what I think you are. So I want to make sure our listeners get to know you better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've got a few questions for you, Ted. If we can go way back to young Ted. Ted, how did young Ted get in the music business?
Well, I started piano, you know, back around 6 or 7 years old. Then I got interested in other things, and that kind of fell by the wayside. But for the most part, I grew up in a fairly musical family. My family did a lot of singing, and we would go to nursing homes and stuff like that. And then once I got back into piano, then I became, you know, the resident piano player for my family anytime we went out. So that was the very early beginnings of it all.
Did you have lessons?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I had, like I said, I had a few lessons when I was at 6 or 7. And then I also had piano lessons, I want to say when I was around 14, 15, maybe for a couple years. And that was my teacher at the time mostly played by ear and music theory, not necessarily, I mean, he could read notes and everything, and he tried to get me to read notes, but I was a little too stubborn for that. So he just stuck with teaching me theory and playing by ear.
So when you were at that age, did you have any idea that you wanted to be a musician when you grew up?
I think I had a really strong desire for it. But I was also a sports person too, so I had some pulls in that direction as well. So as I was younger, there were, it was kind of unique for most musicians from what I hear. Usually we don't have to pick too hard between music and sports because we're usually pretty crappy at them.
Right. What were your sports, by the way?
Baseball and soccer, but baseball was my pretty big love.
Wow, no kidding. So you were almost a baseball player instead of a hammered dulcimer guy, huh?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Wow, no kidding. So you're at age, what, 13, 14, you took some lessons. Now where are we in your process?
So I think I started to play for church at the Sunday evening services and play, you know, to give the morning guy a rest. And that was my main outlet for music at that point. And then throughout throughout my teenage years up to my 20s, I would just play at various church functions, and every now and then I would accompany somebody at a talent show or at a live gig or something like that. And of course I did the typical thing where I moved to different states here and there to be part of bands and stuff like that.
Okay, so when you were with bands, were they faith-based bands or rock bands? Where were you on that?
Yeah, I say for the most part, they were faith-based bands that I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay, so you're going along and you were a pianist. How did dulcimer come into this, by the way?
Well, in the late 80s, I heard a musician by the name of Rich Mullins, and I was a really big fan of his, and he played hammer dulcimer. When I first heard it on the recordings, I thought it was just a synthesizer or something else that I didn't know about. And then, of course, I read liner notes and stuff. But then once I saw him in concert and saw him play it and heard it live, it just totally captured me. And it took me, you know, 10 years to find one once I first saw it played, just because, you know, you couldn't walk into your local guitar center and pick one out.
Right.
So that was a long journey of actually getting to the point of actually owning a hammer dulcimer.
No kidding. So in this time, were you still playing piano for a living, or how did you support yourself as a musician?
Well, yeah, I wasn't doing it for a living on any stretch of the imagination during that time. So it was more of just a hobby, and I was just a typical blue collar worker for the most part during those years.
Got it. So when you were young and you're playing piano and you're in, you know, your bands and all that, who were your biggest influences musically?
So I'd have to say Rich Mullins for sure.
Right.
He was a great lyric writer and a wonderful musician. The other really big influence was a jazz group that I caught a little over 30 years ago now, called Acoustic Alchemy. And I fell in love with them. I listened to jazz quite often, on a regular basis when, you know, I was younger. And, but I always, for some reason, Acoustic Alchemy just grabbed me, and I have been a huge fan of theirs for many years now.
Nice. So that influences your style, I imagine.
I think so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You found a dulcimer. About what age were you then?
Well, I'll have to think real quick as far as just when I was married. I know it was 1997.
Uh-huh.
And my wife and I moved down to Arkansas to, right after we were married, to just be with friends and do music down there. And that's where I first found a hammer dulcimer. She took some wedding money that we had left over and went up into the mountains there and found me a dulcimer and bought me one.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
I think I was 25, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. So you got one. And did that start changing your life? Did you take to it, or did it take a while to get into it?
I am totally self-taught. So yes, it did take a while, just mostly because all of my music theory knowledge and application was built on the chromatic instrument and the dulcimer. Mm-hmm. The dulcimer is a fifth tuned instrument, so it's a very different tuning scheme Yeah, so that took a lot just to really figure that out.
No kidding. I could imagine that would be different. Yeah, I've never played one. I've never seen one at a guitar center either,
right.
By the way.
No.
Yeah, but the way you play it, you know, it's. I don't want to say it has some of the same movements of a vibraphone, but way different, you know, strings and way more complicated, I would think, too. When did you start coming into it and really feeling that this was where you belong?
Well, I spent many years frustrated because I had the music in my head that I wanted to make on it, but I didn't have the knowledge of the instrument and the technical skill to make it happen. So many of those years that I would probably say the first 10 years I owned one, it was mostly just a frustration of... And a very slow learning process.
Wow. No kidding.
Yeah. So in 2007, we had a car accident, and at the time we were living out in the suburbs of Chicago, and I was the only one that got hurt, thankfully, but it derailed me for about 8 months. And so I had to switch jobs. And during that recovery time was when I really started to just have some real conversations with me and God about my legacy and what I really wanted to do on this earth while I was here. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big stepping stone to stepping out into music. And I knew that the hammer dulcimer was the instrument I wanted to do that with. So I always had this deep love and connection to the instrument, like I was made to play it. And because people always ask me all the time, what drew you to this? Why did it pull you away from piano? And I don't have any other answer other than it satisfies me so much to play it.
This is, you are in your lane, basically. This is where you belong. Is that what you're saying?
I sure hope so, because I'm living here.
I guess so. No kidding. So coming for that's very interesting that you wrestled with it for 10 years, you know, and self-taught. And, you know, today you're just like, you know, it looks so effortlessly for you when you're playing.
Well, I'm glad of that, because that means something's paying off.
There you go. So how do you make a living as a hammer dulcimer artist way back in after your car, you know, car accident?
So most of the time it was, when it started, I just went down. I mean, within the place that we lived, we had three or four assisted living places. And mm-hmm. so I just went to all three of them, or yeah, I think there was just three. And I went to all of them and just asked them if I could come and play. And I wasn't even asking for money, but one, they all agreed to pay me for it.
Nice.
The second thing was I didn't even have 45 minutes of music that I could play. So I mm-hmm. had to learn stuff really quick. And when I was, the third thing is when I was asking them and introducing them to the hammered dulcimer, I just had a picture of it. And I actually played them other people's hammered dulcimer music on my iPod because I didn't have any recordings of my own to show them what I played. So I played them other people's music and I said, well, this is what it sounds like.
Okay. Well, there's a way to get around it right there.
So wow. that was the start of it all. And then 2008, I made my first CD just in my basement. I went down to Nashville uh-huh. there and had people edit, master, and mix down there. And,
wow.
And so that was the beginning of it all.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so what has happened since that first CD?
Oh, I'll try not to make it too long. So in 2010, I won the national championship, the Hammer Dulcimer National Championship at a festival down in Winfield, Kansas.
Serious?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, self-taught, struggled for 10 years to teach it to yourself, and you won it?
Yes, I did. Wow.
Cool. Nice.
Yeah.
Keep going.
So that, at the time, I was still working a full-time job, and mm-hmm. I actually got fired from that job 10 days before I went to compete. And my wife, the wonderful person that she is, just said, look, just go down there, act like you still have a job, and we're just on vacation. Compete and we'll worry about the job when you get back. And that wow. was 2010. Like I said, I got fired. I won and I haven't had a full-time job since. So
your wife, you have to marry her if you haven't already.
I know, telling right? you.
Yeah. Bought you the dulcimer is right behind you the whole way there.
Oh, wow. Yes. Yeah. The road that we've traveled that I wouldn't have survived or had the tenacity if it wasn't for her. So I say we
and what's
a lot
her name?
With people. Her name is Donna.
Donna. And, okay, go ahead.
So I say we a lot when I'm talking to people and they're like, oh, you're in a band. I said, no, that's just me and my wife. I just have to include her when I talk.
Hats off to Donna. I mean, yeah. truly, it takes yeah. a strong partner yep. to risk this being a musician. You know, that's this is a scary gig. You know?
Oh, gosh, yes.
It yeah. really is. So, okay. So you're going, you won the competition. What mm-hmm. happens now?
So we basically grabbed that at the time, of course, you know, we just did gigs on the weekends, that kind of thing. And so, mm-hmm. but after I won, that kind of opened up the door into a community of dulcimer festivals and stuff that I didn't even know existed. And so because I had the title, I was able to contact all these other festivals and just introduce myself and say, hey, I'm the current champion, just won. How do you normally run things? And so that kind of helped us in those early years to keep busy, for one, and mm-hmm. to actually not have a day job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though we lived on rice and potatoes for quite some time, too. So,
understandable.
Yeah.
And you have kids, too, right?
I do. At the time, we had 5 children. Right now, we have 7, though. So that's
overachiever. You, yeah, jeez, right. Wow, that's man, 7 kids, and hats off again to Donna for her part in this too. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So, what was the big break? Tell me about it. I love this story.
Oh, well, yeah. So 2016 rolls around and. I'm just about done. I even took a part-time job here in my little town of Goshen, Indiana, at a soup kitchen, just to kind of have a place where I could go to take my mind off of the business and just not right. be a musician for once, you know?
Right.
And so in that fall, I continued to do gigs, but my calendar kept filling up and pretty soon I was putting in way too many hours that anybody should actually put in just at both ends of the candle there. And so in fall of 2016, I was about ready to just say, okay, I think I'm probably done with this music thing. I don't think I have anything left to give it. And Facebook had just come out with Facebook Live.
And
we've always done stuff on YouTube and different things like that. So we thought, you know, this might be a good thing. We'll just put something up on Facebook. And that way I don't have to do any edits. It's just a one take thing, you know, and it's up there. So the first time we did a Facebook Live thing, we had, I think, one live person and a total of maybe 14 views or something like that. It was pretty menial. Uh-huh. So the next week, Donna asked me, "Well, are you going to play live again?" I said, "I don't know. Didn't get a lot of attention last time." So she said, "Well, what are you going to play?" I said, "I don't know. Maybe I'll try and finish up that one song, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, just to see what happens and see if I can get that finally finished." And so we went out there and we had tornadoes to the south of us that were coming in. So we needed to get some stuff done so we could get inside and be safe. And our Wi-Fi wasn't working right. So we had to keep moving closer to the house and different things like that. And so I got on and we played Everybody Wants to Rule the World. And, our phones started beeping after we were all done. I don't remember how many people we had live. I want to say probably 14, maybe 70 people, somewhere in between. So our phones literally were starting to alarm us and saying, there's tornadoes in the area. You need to get inside. So we're literally like packing up and just running down the basement. And so, yeah, later that night, when I went to bed, oh, shoot, I wish Donna was in here because I can't remember my numbers. But we had at least more shares, I think maybe 70 shares. And we thought, oh, that's pretty cool. And just went to bed, didn't think anything of it. And so that was a Wednesday night. Thursday morning when I woke up, we had over 31,000 views.
Oh, wow.
And I went to work, not thinking anything of it. Thursday night, we hit 500,000 views. And before I went to bed on Thursday evening, we hit 1,000,000 views.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, my God. How did that feel?
I think those are the right numbers. Yeah. Pretty ridiculous. I mean, we still didn't know what was happening. We thought, wow, this is kind of cool. You know, people are talking about it. They're sharing it. This is kind of fun. But we still didn't realize anything was really happening yet until I went to work on Friday morning and my phone was getting so many updates from Twitter, Facebook, and, you know, different things like that. It literally died in 2 hours because it just kept getting these notifications. I was like, what is going on?
Wow.
And then my nephew called me and he said, "Dude, do you know what's happening?" I said, "Well, I don't know, not really." He said, "You have like over 10 million views on this video on Facebook." And he did all the numbers and he literally figured out that I was at one point I was getting 1,000 views a second. And it was just crazy. Gosh. And so it started getting some funny attention from different places. Of course, the guys from Tears for Fears. And and then there was a good friend of mine actually now that works for the Huff Post. She writes for the Huff Post, and she didn't know me before that, so we're good friends now. But she wanted to talk to me about it and have an interview, and so I think we talked on Saturday, and no, it was Friday afternoon. I think it was Friday afternoon. Because she said, "This is crazy." She said, "I'll tell you, just from what I've seen before and what's happening now," she said, you're going to hit over, what did Christy? She said, over 50 million this weekend. And I thought, okay, well, we'll see. That's kind of cool. And, I think, did we actually hit 100 million? No, it was 54 million. It was 54 million by Sunday.
Just 54 million. Yeah, right.
Right.
Wow.
So yeah, that all happened in 5 days.
So was that a sign, do you think, that you're in your right space where you should be? and not give up?
Yeah, at the time, definitely, yes. It was, I am, yeah, it was okay. Wow. I guess we're not going to hang it up after all.
I guess not. So right, that's such a cool story. I love hearing that. And what better guy than you and your family to have that happen to? So now let's fast forward. How many CDs do you have out right now?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have 5 CDs out right now, and we just finished up a brand new one that's in the mixing stage.
We have 6 CDs. Oh, cool. Nice. And then are these, most of these, your original work, or are you covering songs, or is it a combination?
It's a combination, yes. Yep.
Uh-huh. Nice. Now, when do you, with 7 kids, by the way, and limited wireless at your house, when do you have time to write music? What's your writing process like? How do you get it done?
Oh, it's such an interesting process, because as any musician will attest to, some songs take 5 months, some songs write themselves in about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I like the new album has one song on it that was written in January, and I was recording it in February, because it just happened that quick. I liked the movement of it. I played it for other people. They were like, nothing's wrong with that one, you know? So some songs just kind of pop out like that. This one in particular, I was driving down to Florida from Northern Indiana. So it was, you know, like an 18-hour trip or something like that.
Right.
And I just, you know, stopped at a hotel just south of Macon, Georgia, and just pulled out the dulcimer and started playing a rhythm that was in my head. And I would imagine it was probably the rhythm, you know, of just the road noise going at 75 miles an hour down the interstate. And so it's called Rhythm of the Road. And it just literally just wrote itself right there. And I did very few changes to it.
Interesting. You mentioned that. I just saw the movie Bolden. It was about the founder of jazz, a cornetist named Buddy Bolden in New Orleans. Okay. And he, as a child, would lay on the floor of where his mom worked in a sewing machine factory.
Oh, nice.
And just by the beats of the machines and everything, that's how he got his composing going.
That's awesome. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. So, but a lot of times I think my writing is actually mostly birthed out of when I'm woodshedding my instrument, when I'm practicing a certain rhythm, I'm practicing a certain scale, trying to get my left hand to do something that my right hand does naturally. Just those kinds of things. It's amazing to me how many things are birthed out that way.
So would you say that your writing the songs come to you while you're at your instrument mostly?
Yes.
Or do they come to you? Okay.
Yeah.
And I always like to figure out, you know, because I get different answers from different artists on that. I sometimes get songs that come out at the gym. You know, I'm on a machine. It's like, oh, I've got to get home and remember that. Oh, please.
I have a couple songs on the new album that were inspired while I was mowing the lawn, and I was kind of getting this rhythm through my head and some parts of melodies. And so then I would just quickly finish the lawn, grab my instrument and start playing. There's different, I would probably say for the most part, because I play a rhythmic instrument, 9 out of 10 times, most of what I get first is the rhythm of the song.
I hear that. Yes. Cause you definitely have a rhythmic instrument for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So out of the 5, almost 6 CDs that you've had since you at one time said, oh, I might just give it all up. And now you're on your 6th one. Mm-hmm. What, if you could, out of all these great songs you have, and we play a lot of them on the River of Calm, I love your work. What is your favorite song, if you can quantify that?
That is hard to quantify, because again, as an artist, you know, when you write a new song, a lot of times you dive deeper, mentally, emotionally, and technically, typically, you know, it has a lot to it. So, a lot of my favorite songs are on the new album that's not out yet. But that's mostly just because it's new, it's fresh, it's there, sitting there. But I think still one song that always means a lot to me is from my Chocolate Skies album called Awakening. And
Awakening, is that correct?
Yep, Awakening. At the time when I wrote that song, I had a sister who was going through a divorce, not of her own free will. And it was just a new thing for us. And I live right down the road from her. And so I was walking with her through that process. And I mean, I love my sister dearly. I love my brother-in-law dearly. And so it was very, I wouldn't pretend that it was as hard for me as it was for her, but it weighed on me a lot. And I literally hadn't played the dulcimer probably for 2 months during that whole ordeal. And finally, I was up one morning way too early than any human being should ever be awake at. And the sun was rising. There was mist out on the cornfields, and it was just this beautiful thing. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to grab my dulcimer. I'm going to go outside. I'm just going to play. And I did that. And that was the song that was birthed out that morning.
Wow. Awakening. Mm-hmm. And we still happen to have that song here. So let's just take a moment to listen to Ted Yoder's Awakening. Thank you. And there it is, the song that was birthed by so many things and your cornfield at the same time, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, where can we find your music, Ted?
TedYoderMusic.com, or you can just go to TedYoder.com and go to the shop from there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm all over iTunes, Spotify, anywhere streaming music is too.
Isn't that a full-time job alone, trying to get yourself everywhere?
Oh, gosh, yes. I wish you could just put it out there once and everybody would just find it.
I hear you loud and clear, but you have so much good music. And while yours is awakening, I still love your take and your rendition of The Water is Wide.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
you did a great job on that.
Thank
Musically,
you.
On your whole career, what do you think you're the most proud of?
Whew.
And again, you're proud of your kids and your wife and all that, but musically, let's get to that domain.
Oh, boy. Musically. I have a new song, and I hate to just put this one out there because it's not available yet. I have a song called Indiana Skies, and I like it on a number of levels because I actually started writing it for a film for Kansas State University. And but it was one of those songs that was birthed while I was mowing the lawn. And it has just a lot of different movements in it, and it's probably more more soundtracky sounding than some of my other stuff. But there's some certain technical skills in there that, I was proud of that I mastered to make that song happen.
Nice. And that's going to be out on your new CD, right?
Yes. Yes.
Indiana Skies. I'm going to have to check that one out, and listeners, make sure you check it out too. Wow. Okay. So with all this, you win the championship, you have Tears for Fears inviting you to their place. No, they came to your place, right?
They came to my place, yes.
Yeah, you had 54 million or so views, yeah, and all that stuff. Do you ever have fear or self-doubt as a musician?
Without hesitation, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean all the time.
What scares you the most?
That I'll never be quite enough to make this happen and to keep to sustain it. Every time I write a new song, I'm putting my heart out there on the line for people to love it or hate it.
Risking right there. That really is.
Oh, it is. Especially in this day and age of social media where everybody has a voice. And, you know, I mean, and I'm not. I don't want to just say this as a name drop, but when I was talking to Kurt Smith and Jamie Wollum from Tears for Fears, I asked them about it because that was very fresh. You know, I was getting a lot more comments and just all kinds of stuff while that whole viral thing was happening. So I asked them, I said, how do you guys handle it? And, and Kurt in his wonderful English accent said, oh no, I don't. He said, I put stuff up and I never read comments. I wouldn't be able to handle that.
Understandable. It's cruel out there. It's cruel.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for you, though, you have, you know, what a lovely gift that you transcend with your music, you know, in the vibe that you put out there. You know, if anyone's messing with you, come to me. I'll handle them.
I have a few big sisters that would beat up anybody. Literal and figurative big sisters that would,
okay.
Out anybody for me. If I have my own Italian mob, let's put it that way.
All right, then you're covered then.
I think so.
All right. So tell me, aside from Lawn Boy being your co-writer on so many of your songs, what is one thing that most people don't know about Ted Yoder?
I was kicked out of high school during my junior year. So
really,
yeah, I really probably should have belonged back in the 50s or 60s, but I guess I was just rebel enough that they didn't want me there.
Okay, well, you totally don't look like a ruffian, you know. Oh man, don't piss off the dulcimer
that's
guy,
right,
whatever
that's
you
right.
do.
I carry two hammers with me all the time.
I guess so. Oh my gosh. All right. So if you were granted a magic wish with a wand, a musical wish, what's that wish going to be? Oh.
I think honestly, just maybe this isn't a musical wish, but it is indirectly, I guess, that I would still be able to provide for my family making music.
Mm-hmm. It seems, understandable.
Seems very practical, but
practical, but a big responsibility too.
It is. It is, and that, and as much as I thrive on the stories of my fans when they come to see me and how my music affects them and stuff like that, and that stuff fuels me in a totally different way. But to be able to do this and know that my family is fed and taken care of and provided for, that still probably touches me more emotionally deeply than any of the other stuff.
What a blessing. What a true blessing that is. Wow. Wow. All right. Got one more question. And then again, this is Tim Ferriss has the 4-hour work week. He has a podcast I've listened to. And one of the questions he asks is, if you had one billboard that you could have across the country that would spread your message, what would be on that billboard?
I think I would have to say, never forget that we're all human.
You are deep for a guy who was kicked out in his junior year, I'm telling you.
I don't mean to make that sound heavier than it is, but I think that's just a big thing for me is I've always told my kids in this family, no matter what hardships we go through, how angry we get at each other or how hurt, never forget that we're human and we need to treat each other that way. And that means that to me, that goes on a lot of different levels. And I think this world could use a little more of that.
Well said, Ted. And truly, congratulations on your career and your braveness to put yourself out there, you know, as you have. And look, you are so blessed. You're 7 kids. You have Donna. Mm-hmm. You have people that love you. You have 54 million people that know you. And they can find out more about you at tedyoder.com, right?
That's it.
All right. Well, then there you have it. A behind-the-scenes look at hammered dulcimer artist Ted Yoder on the River of Calm's Beyond the Music podcast. I'm your host, Ed Basil, and the River of Calm is music to soothe your soul. And may the calm be with you.